And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. Great to be back with you on this seemingly spring morning. And we have a packed program today. In the first hour, we'll check in with political analyst Eric Davis and then Steve Terry. And then we'll check in with Alex Apple, reporter for WCAX, who flew the Sanders plane back to New Hampshire last night. And, of course, what we'll be talking about are the Iowa caucus. And then we'll turn our attention to a very interesting story about an ongoing criminal investigation against Vermont environmentalist Aunt Annette Smith. Who's behind these charges against Smith? No one is saying. We'll review what is going on and take your phone calls on your take to this very bizarre story that involves industrial wind, the AG's office, developers, law firms, and politics. But first, let's turn our attention to Iowa. And on the line with us this morning is Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Mike.
So, Eric, what's your take on what happened last night?
Well, my take on the Democratic side is that if you look at expectations for Bernie Sanders back in April when he announced he would be running, I think very few people thought that he would, in effect, finish in a dead heat with Hillary Clinton in Iowa and have a lead in New Hampshire a week before that state's primary. So at least in this early stage of the campaign, Sanders is exceeding expectations. Now, the real challenge for him comes in the later primaries in February in South Carolina and Nevada. And then once you get to Super Tuesday and beyond in March, when there'll be a lot of states, including big states, holding primaries. So on the Republican side, there were several things that struck me in the results there. First, I think Donald Trump underperformed. I think it's pretty clear that his supporters couldn't be motivated to actually turn out and vote for him at the caucus. That may indicate Trump is not as strong organizationally as he is in terms of rhetoric and media attention. Ted Cruz was able to have an excellent ground game, focusing particularly on evangelical voters who aren't as important in other states as they are in Iowa. And Marco Rubio finished a strong third. And again, I think all of these candidates face challenges now in New Hampshire. Trump will get back, will try and get back into first place. For Cruz, it's a state that's demographically less favorable to him than Iowa was. And Rubio will try and finish ahead of the other mainstream candidates, Bush, Christie, and Kasich in New Hampshire.
Eric, let's talk a little bit about the ground game, because in Iowa, it is all about the ground game. And Cruz obviously had a good ground game there. Clinton and Sanders had great ground games,
exactly,
as well as Rubio. Trump probably less so, but as you turn to New Hampshire, is the ground game in a primary as opposed to a caucus as important as it is in Iowa?
No, there's a big difference between voting in the New Hampshire primary, where you just go into a booth and cast a secret ballot, and going to a caucus in Iowa, where you go to a meeting and listen to speeches for a while and then announce your preference. What I'm interested in New Hampshire is, first of all, Trump. Polls indicate that he's doing well there. So much of his brand is about being a winner. And the fact that he finished second in Iowa, will that cause some of his supporters in New Hampshire to reassess, or will they stick with him and try and put him back into that first place position in the actual results?
And almost third, Eric.
Right. I mean, Rubio almost caught him. And, you know, I wonder if Rubio's campaign are thinking if they had only spent a few more days in Iowa, could they have actually finished second? I'm interested to see how much time Cruz spends in New Hampshire over the next week, or whether he goes right to South Carolina, makes an appearance in New Hampshire, of course, but really spends most of his time in South Carolina between now and that state's primary later in February. And Bush and Kasich and Christie, who've been putting a lot of effort, a lot of advertising into New Hampshire, they're obviously going to try and derail whatever momentum Rubio has coming out of New Hampshire.
It's interesting. Everybody, at least Clinton, Sanders, Cruz, Trump, Rubio, they're all claiming they won. Was there any losers?
Yeah, I think there were some losers. I think Trump did not live up to expectations. So I think he tried to put a good spin on it and was more subdued last night in his speech than he usually is in his speeches. But I think he underperformed last night. And I think the other underperformer was Jeb Bush, who, you know, spent a lot of money early in Iowa and ended up with a single-digit vote share. And now, really, New Hampshire becomes critical for him in terms of resuscitating his campaign. If he finishes behind Rubio in New Hampshire, I wonder how long those donors to the Bush super PAC are going to keep putting money into that organization.
Does anybody have momentum? Obviously, Bernie Sanders is ahead right now in New Hampshire, according to the polls. And I would suspect, Eric, that the polls are probably more accurate in a primary state than they are in a caucus state.
But yeah. And the other thing about New Hampshire is there's a track record there that Democrats from neighboring states tend to do well there. Now, they've all been from Massachusetts. So that's Michael Dukakis, Paul Tsongas, and John Kerry. But you know, Vermont, obviously, is a neighboring state. Sanders is well-known there, and I think that will help him, too. So I'd be surprised if Sanders did not win in New Hampshire next Tuesday.
So let's talk a little bit about the Democratic side now. Let's presuppose that Sanders does win in New Hampshire. It turns south after that to South Carolina.
Right.
And he has an uphill battle in South Carolina, it looks like.
Yeah, he has an uphill battle because all the polls so far indicate that he's not making inroads among African-American voters. The electorates in Iowa and New Hampshire are overwhelmingly white. But in the Democratic Party nationally, African-Americans and Latino voters make up an important part of the primary and caucus electorate. It's estimated that about half the Democratic primary voters in South Carolina are African-American, and about a third in Nevada are Latino. And Sanders needs to demonstrate in those two states that he can appeal to the very diverse voting coalition that makes up the whole Democratic Party. And those states are going to be big tests for him. And how he does in those two states, I think, will say a lot about what he does on Super Tuesday. He's obviously going to win Vermont on March 1st. But how many other states could he win on March 1st? There are, I believe, eight southern states that vote on March 1st, and then there are three other states outside the South, in addition to Vermont, Colorado, Minnesota, and Massachusetts.
And, of course, Clinton's been down this road before. She's seen this slip away before in those early sort of caucus, Iowa caucus, and then, of course, Obama came in really strong second in New Hampshire, and then he took South Carolina. In essence, he took the early primary states. What does she have to do now?
Well, I think what Hillary Clinton needs to do is she can afford to lose in New Hampshire. I think what she has to do is win convincingly in South Carolina and Nevada to put her into a good position for Super Tuesday. The other thing we have to remember, Mike, though, is if you look back, the Iowa and New Hampshire results aren't necessarily predictive of who's won into the presidency a year from now. The last non-incumbent person who was neither president nor vice president came in, got more votes than anybody else in both Iowa and New Hampshire, and then won the presidency was Jimmy Carter in 1976. Mm-hmm. Every other president since then has lost at least one of those states. Newly elected President Reagan lost Iowa to George H.W. Bush in 1980. Clinton lost New Hampshire to Tsongas in 92. George W. Bush lost New Hampshire to McCain in 2000, and Obama lost New Hampshire to Clinton in 2008. So just winning those two states doesn't necessarily mean you're gonna be sworn into office.
Switching to the Republicans, Eric, Trump's mantra has been, you know, vote for me because I'm ahead. That's been taken away from him in Iowa.
Exactly.
And so do you expect that it may have an impact in New Hampshire, where he has shown that he's been sort of ahead in the polls?
Exactly. And it could be. And I'm also interested to see whether Trump unleashes just a barrage of negative campaigning in New Hampshire. Is he going to resort to insults and name-calling and negative ads attacking Ted Cruz for having been born in Canada, for having received loans from Goldman Sachs when he was a Senate candidate? Is he going to attack Marco Rubio on aspects of his voting record, changing his position in the past, missing votes in the Senate, and all those sorts of things? So Trump obviously has the money to do that. The question is, I'm not sure how much advertising time is left on New Hampshire stations now between now and next Tuesday. It may be all sold out by now.
He's in trouble if he loses New Hampshire, I would
say. Yeah, because again, South Carolina has a lot of evangelical voters, which is good territory for Cruz. And the eight southern states, again, that's going to be a big test for Trump. The eight southern states on Super Tuesday, if Cruz or Rubio can do well in some of those states, the air may start to come out of the Trump balloon quite fast, so to speak.
So we have Jeb Bush, Kasich, and Christie making their stand in New Hampshire. What do they have to do?
Well, I think all of them have to finish ahead of Rubio, because if Rubio finishes first among that group of four, he can then go on and say, I'm the leading candidate among the so-called mainstream group. And then he will try and make a case, particularly to the donors who've been supporting super PACs of those other candidates. You know, it's time to call it quits. Join me. If the vote for the other three is combined with mine, we have more than either Trump or Cruz. And he'll say that he could put together a winning coalition against either Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders, because he could appeal to centrist voters in ways that neither Trump nor Cruz could. So I think that would be Rubio's argument. And Kasich, Christie, and Bush need to figure out a way to counter that. Now, Kasich and Christie in particular have been spending a very large amount of time in New Hampshire. They've been going to lots of meetings, doing lots of town hall events and things like that. So I'll be interested to see whether New Hampshire voters, who do like to see their candidates in the flesh, will reward Kasich and Christie for having spent so much time in that state.
And, of course, each of them has an endorsement. Kasich got the endorsement of the New York Times, which may be the kiss of death in the Republican primary.
Right.
And Christie got the Manchester Union Leader.
And the New York Times, the Boston Globe also endorsed Kasich in New Hampshire. And I think where the Globe and the Times endorsements might help a little bit. Among core Republican voters, obviously, those endorsements are, as you say, the kiss of death. But in New Hampshire, independents can decide which party's primary they want to vote in. And if there's independents who have some reservations about Hillary Clinton on issues of ethics and transparency, who think Bernie Sanders may be a little bit too far to the left, and are looking at the Republican candidates, an endorsement of Kasich by the Globe could, you know, give him a point or two in the vote, which in a very competitive primary, especially in this crowded mainstream lane, so to speak, could make a difference.
Who is Clinton most concerned about? Would it be Rubio?
I think Rubio is the one who has the most potential of damaging Clinton in the fall. I think, you know, obviously he's much younger and can present himself as coming from a different generation than she. I think, as I said before, he has more opportunity to appeal to centrist and independents. I think between now and the convention, I think Clinton, to be candid, has to be concerned as much about the investigations into her server and her email as she does about Bernie Sanders, because career prosecutors in the Justice Department have brought charges against former officials for things that have not been dissimilar from what's been reported about Clinton. David Petraeus was one of them. Sandy Berger, who was a former national security advisor to Bill Clinton, is another one. So I could see a career prosecutor arguing to the political people in the Justice Department that what she has done does satisfy the criteria for bringing charges. And, you know, obviously the political people would try and sit on it as much as they can, but that sort of story does leak out. And, you know, I think that fits into again, we don't want to overinterpret the results of one state, but polls from Iowa last night indicated the concerns voters had about Clinton weren't so much about the issues. They tended to agree with her on the issues, but either they thought she didn't have empathy for average voters like themselves, or they were concerned about her ethics and integrity.
Yeah, I saw that poll. The trust factor was astonishing, the difference between Sanders and Clinton.
That's right. And, you know, Sanders, you know, he's a new face. You know, the fact that he doesn't take money from PACs and super PACs, I think, does make a difference among Democratic primary and caucus voters.
What does Sanders have to do in the next few weeks?
Win as big as he can in New Hampshire. Spend a lot of time with African-American and Latino voters in Nevada and South Carolina. Hope that even if he doesn't win those two, he can hold Clinton to a single-digit margin. And then find some states on Super Tuesday that he can win in addition to Vermont. I think probably Colorado Massachusetts and Minnesota would be his best targets. But some of these southern states are changing a lot. I think Virginia and North Carolina have somewhat different demographics than the deeper south, and those might be good targets for Sanders also.
Clinton has the superdelegates pretty much wrapped up in terms of the number that she has compared to Bernie Sanders. I think he has 8 of, and
yeah,
she has 200 and something. When did they start getting really antsy?
I think they start getting antsy if Sanders starts doing well in big states, especially states that are important in the Electoral College. As I mentioned, we have North Carolina and Virginia voting on Super Tuesday. A few weeks later into March, we have Ohio and Michigan and Florida. And these are all the sorts of states that make a difference in the Electoral College. So if by mid-March, Clinton is not consistently winning these large, electorally important states, then I think the superdelegates start getting concerned whether they go to Bernie Sanders or start talking again about Joe Biden entering the race. I think that remains to be seen.
That is going to be a fascinating, because the establishment clearly is behind Clinton. You can talk about the debates, and let's talk about the debate. I mean, there's been an added debate, which wasn't planned, because there was a limited debate. Some of the debates, the timing were questionable, the Saturday night before Christmas. There has been a debate that's been added, primarily because I think Clinton needs a debate, doesn't she?
Yeah, Clinton needs it. Now, formally, it's not called a debate. It's called something like a forum or a town hall or something like that. And that gets around the DNC's claim that there will not be more than 6 debates. But there is another televised joint appearance of all of Clinton and Sanders in New Hampshire this week. And the Republicans have a debate coming up, too. For undecided voters, people who wait until the last minute, I think these upcoming debates will make a big difference. And again, with Trump, my guess is even if Megyn Kelly is one of the moderators in a future debate, he's going to show up.
Not going
to that debate last week is one of the things that hurt Trump.
He ain't sitting out the next one. I can almost guarantee that. Hey, Eric, it's always great to hear from you and always great to get your opinions. This is Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College. Thank you, Eric, very much.
My pleasure, Mike.
This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're talking all things Iowa in this first hour today. We just spoke with Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, to get his take. Next up is Steve Terry, who's a WCAX political analyst. Steve, good morning.
Morning, Mike. How are you?
Great, thank you. Just wanted to ask you some of the same questions that I asked Eric. So what was your takeaway from the Iowa caucuses?
Obviously, the most amazing event for those of us in Vermont, at least, was the strong and showing by Bernie Sanders. I mean, he started the evening kind of slow, but as the evening wore on, it looked as if he was going to put it over the top. I think that it has to be for him a moral victory, if not an actual victory. And I think it really helps him in New Hampshire even more. Now, on the Republican side, it was pretty clear that everybody had wrong the strength of the Cruz ground game, which was actually based on both religious fervor, it seemed, but they had some extremely high-tech ways, I gather, in counting and measuring and getting out their vote. I think that the fact that that when the voters finally had a chance, that Donald Trump did not prevail, clearly takes a lot of wind out of his sails. although he's very strong at the moment in New Hampshire, and Marco Rubio certainly was another surprise of the evening. I wonder how well Rubio will do in New Hampshire. He's in fifth place at the moment. But as we know, Mike, election results result also in great momentum. So that will be what I will be watching in New Hampshire, which is, of course, a primary state and a very different way candidates get selected.
We're speaking with Steve Terry, who's the WCAX political analyst. If you wish to join our conversation, we're talking all things Iowa today and the results from the Iowa caucus. Give us a call at our WDEV studios, 802-244-1777, or toll free at 877-291-8255. Everybody's claiming to be a winner. Were there any losers?
Well, yes, I think certainly Dr. Carson and that lower half of the ticket, certainly Jeb Bush, my gosh, if he doesn't do well in New Hampshire or better than Iowa, I think it's the end of the road for him pretty soon. I think now that the race is starting on the Republican side to be down to three or four candidates, we will see a much more spirited campaign there. It is interesting now that Governor O'Malley has dropped out. We will actually see a head-to-head debate now between Bernie Sanders and Mrs. Clinton. I suspect this will turn into a sharper discussion. I suspect that that Bernie will not be able to resist the email issue. I completely agreed with Eric that hanging as a dark cloud over the Clinton campaign is what happens with this email investigation. That is a dynamic that we have not seen before. So I think that I will be watching to see if Rubio can split the anger vote in New Hampshire. I will be watching to see if Bernie continues his momentum in New Hampshire. But I'm also remembering, Mike, in 2004, I was on a leave of absence and worked in the Howard Dean campaign in New Hampshire. And when Howard Dean came in third in Iowa, and then, of course, his scream, he arrived in New Hampshire very early the next morning in a very cold airport hangar in Portsmouth. He was leading the race. He was expected to do better, but because of Iowa and the negative feelings that started to emerge, he, of course, lost to John Kerry in 2004, and pretty soon Howard Dean dropped out of the campaign. I don't see Bernie yet really having any doubt now that he will continue. I actually saw on his face last night, and it'll be interesting to hear Alex Apple, but I actually saw something I've never seen before. I saw on the face of Bernie Sanders pure joy when he was speaking to his supporters about 1 o'clock this morning. And the fact that, as we know, he's got money. He raised $20 million in January alone. He had spent or had raised $73 million in 2015. So he has the oxygen, he has the resources to continue for a while.
Presidential politics, as you just explained, is a game of expectations. And Bernie certainly met, as you just mentioned, met his expectations in Iowa. Did Clinton meet her expectations? And is she wounded going into New Hampshire? And then all important is Nevada and South Carolina after that.
I just have to think that in the Clinton campaign this morning, they are once again trying to figure out what went wrong. I mean, it is remarkable that she had such a lead coming into Iowa. She had some of the best people from the Obama campaign in 2008, where, as you know, she lost in Iowa, to try to learn those lessons. But I think it's more that actually Democrats in the U.S. are starting to drift leftward. And I don't think the Clinton people can really capture in a credible way so far that kind of momentum that's happening in, at least nationally, in Democratic politics.
Let's turn a little bit. Well, actually, I want to ask you this question, Steve. You know, Mrs. Clinton has the superdelegates pretty sewed up. And I'm curious, at what point do they start getting worried? I asked Eric about this, and he said it's going to be at the large, if she doesn't do well in the large states. What's your take on it?
Right. I think that's right. But let's remember, just because a super delegate is pledged, it doesn't mean they can't change their mind. And that has certainly happened in the past. Now, it'll obviously, I don't think any of that happens until after Super Tuesday, depending where the race is at that point. It does seem that the super delegates, you know, they read the results like the rest of us, and if there's momentum going a way that's away from their pledged candidates, they can change their mind.
One of Trump's mantras, let's switch to the Republicans for a minute. One of Trump's mantras is that you should vote for me because I'm in the lead. All the polls have me in the lead. Does the results in Iowa take some of the shine off of that message?
Oh, yes. And, you know, frankly, voters in New Hampshire, and I'm sure the voters in Iowa, and maybe voters everywhere, don't, at the end of the day, like arrogance. And a steady diet of arrogance is not a way over time that wins elections, at least in my experience.
We're talking all things Iowa for the first hour this morning. If you wish to join our conversation, call us at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone lines. And Rama from Williamstown, you're on open mic. Good morning, Rama.
Good morning. First, go Bernie. Second off, I don't think it's a matter of the Democratic Party or the independents that are supporting people like Sanders are floating off to the left. I think it is that an awful lot of politicians who have been entrenched down in Washington, D.C., and in a lot of state capitals, for that matter, have floated off to the right side of the politics and have managed to work themselves further away from what is really mainstream America. And I mean, I think I could support that by going through polls after polls on social issues that are supported by huge majorities of people in this country. But I think the interpretation of why Sanders is getting traction and is able to go head to head with Hillary Clinton, I think is flawed if you just view it through the lens of voters floating to the left. It's politicians are floating off to the right side.
Thanks for your phone call, Rama. Steve, what Rama is saying is, has Sanders picked up on the the country moving his way?
Well, I actually think, and it's ironic, there's no more experienced longtime politician than Bernie Sanders, but yet he does not act like a politician. And on that score, I think I would agree with Ron that Americans are, or Democrats and certainly Republicans, are beginning to be attracted to people who do not sound like established politicians. But I do think that there is more on the Democratic side. There is a much stronger sense of populism that I have seen in the last several years than I had witnessed in the past. So I think, and that's also true on the Republican side. Remember, Pat Buchanan won the New Hampshire primary in 1996, I recall, and it was all because he expressed a very strong populist message that was also viewed as anti-establishment.
I mean, we've talked about this on this program before, that Bernie Sanders does have a message that resonates, the haves versus the have-nots message. And it probably hasn't resonated before. I'm trying to think back when this was happening, and probably it's the turn of the 20th century when Teddy Roosevelt and Taft used it in sort of a populist movement the way that Sanders is using it.
Yes, and there is no question that certainly in Vermont, the whole bull moose politics in that era, and that's what, by the way, propelled somebody by the name of George Aiken into that kind of politics as well in Vermont. So we've had it here for a while. But I think, obviously, what has changed now is the incredible impact of social media, the incredible impact of how ideas get discussed very quickly across the country, and how younger voters, and not only younger voters, but are becoming attracted to that kind of talk again and philosophy.
In the first hour, we're talking everything Iowa. So if you want to join this conversation, we're talking about with Steve Terry, who's the political analyst for WCAX, longtime observer of Vermont politics. If you wish to join our conversation, call us at our WDEV studios, 802-244-1777, or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone lines. And Don in Morrisville. Don, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Steve Wolf. You're talking about populists. I guess about the first one was William Jennings Bryan. But you're mentioning arrogance with Trump. At least Trump is paying his own way. He is beholden to no one. Hillary, on the other hand, to me, is the picture of arrogance. From the first time after her husband was elected and she walked into Congress to present her health care program. The heck of it is, I could support her health care program, but it is the way that she comes across. I cannot believe that she has done as well as she did in Iowa just because of it. That woman reeks arrogance from every pore in her body. It is always the same thing, like, I know better than you what's best for you. And when people start to really see that, she's done.
Don, thank you for your phone call. Don brings up an interesting point that perhaps has attracted a lot of people to Trump. He's not beholden to anybody. He's a billionaire on himself. He's paying his own way. Hillary, on the other hand, has been tripped up by her Wall Street connection. Steve, what's your take?
Right, there's no question about that. That one of the things I hear the most about Donald Trump, as I talk to neighbors and voters here, is the fact he is financing his own campaign. And on the other hand, the fact that Bernie does not have a PAC and that he is relying on grassroots donations, small donations that can keep on giving, is a very attractive feature, too. I do think that Bernie Sanders has highlighted the role of and the negative role more and more of big money in politics. He has put a face on that issue, and it has been helped in, frankly, in many ways, that on the other side, Donald Trump can also make the same argument that he's paying his own way. So I think there will be fundamental changes down the road as to how we finance elections in this country.
Let's go to Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Morning. Hey, the last time we had three consecutive administrations of the same party, if my memory works right, it was Reagan-Bush. So my theory is we're not going to have three consecutive administrations this time around either. So I don't think Hillary's going to win. What do you think?
Well, Fred, thank you for your phone call. Steve, that's an interesting point that Fred makes. The public gets tired of various administrations. If they think it's a continuation of the existing administration, will that be a disadvantage to Hillary?
Well, we do like more change and more in American politics. And we're watching that phenomenon right now, Mike, as you and I often talk about what's happening in the Vermont elections. I think there is something to that. It is interesting to me that that Mrs. Clinton is basically wrapped her arms very tightly around President Obama. But if lightning should strike and Bernie Sanders was ever elected, and I must say I think that's a not a likely prospect, but he would not be like any other president we've ever had, or at least in the modern era.
Let's go back to the phone lines, and let's go to Bill. Bill, I've got 1 minute, so if you could really make your question concise or your observation concise, I would appreciate it.
No problem. I'm just curious as to what your guest thinks about the effect on Clinton with regards to social media and the scandals that she's been through over the last two decades. Benghazi, the Whitewater thing, the issue with the guy that was found dead at the White House. All those things are hitting social media. I'm curious how, you know, that's going to impact her in the future.
Yeah, Steve, and you don't have to be accurate when you're on social media. So it's sort of, it's a rumor mill that just keeps going. Does it hurt her?
Oh, yes. And frankly, it is a, it can be a dark cloud over any candidate, because there's almost no way now to get on top of those stories, especially those that are not accurate, and it takes on a life of its own. So this is another major fundamental change in the way we do politics in America, and maybe even more so right here in Vermont.
Steve, as always, we've been speaking with Steve Terry, WCAX political analyst. Steve, as always, it's been great talking to you and getting your perspective. Thank you very much for spending some time with us today.
Thanks, Mike.
Up next, Alex Apple, the CAX reporter. He rode the plane back to New Hampshire, the Sanders plane back to New Hampshire last night. Want to get his perspective on what the Sanders campaign is thinking and feeling after Iowa. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're talking Iowa today, the Iowa caucus, the results, what happened, everything about it. We've been speaking with Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, and Steve Terry, who has been a longtime observer of Vermont politics, is now the WCAX political analyst. And up next is Alex Apple, who's a WCAX reporter, been doing a fabulous job out in Iowa reporting what's going on. And my understanding is rode the plane, the Sanders plane, back to New Hampshire last night. Good morning, Alex. How are you?
Good morning, Mike. I'm great. Rode the Sanders plane back to Manchester, got in around, I would say, around 4 a.m. this morning. Saw the senator walk off the plane looking for somewhere to lay his head. He was pretty tired this morning by the time he got to Manchester. But the campaign now in the Granite State, beginning in earnest.
Any way you can describe what the feeling was on that plane last night?
The feeling on that plane last night was definitely a feeling of excitement. When they got on the plane last night, of course, I'll set the scene for you. Sanders has a rally in Des Moines, thanks his supporters, basically, without saying it explicitly, declares victory, thanks Iowans for starting his political revolution, drives across the street and hops on this plane. And so we were flying with him along with some other media, and he probably had around 20 to 25 staffers with him as well. There was singing, high-fiving. Michael Briggs, Sanders' spokesman, spoke to the media with a big smile on his face most of the time that he was there. Definitely a feeling of excitement, because even though they did not leave Iowa being able to say, we definitely won the popular vote there, what they left Iowa with was a validation that their campaign is for real and can compete with Hillary Clinton, even in a state where 6 months ago she led by like 40 points.
And that's the whole thing with presidential politics. It's a game of expectations. And certainly what I'm hearing this morning, at least from our political analysts, is that Bernie Sanders met that game and then some in that game of expectations. And that's what...
Isn't it funny, how many times have we heard Marco Rubio's soundbite this morning, and he came in third. It's the most celebratory third-place finish that you can have in pretty much anything. But you're right. Politics is all about expectations. And when you came into Iowa, a little-known Vermont senator with a reputation for being a socialist, not many people said you were going to take on the Clinton machine that has run in Iowa so many times and run successfully so many times across this country.
Alex, you did a great job in Iowa. And yesterday you had the opportunity to have a chance to interview Senator Sanders on the bus. What did you learn from that interview?
Well, first off, thank you. I appreciate your saying that. We talked with him after he had just spoken with a group of supporters in the Des Moines campaign office. He was rallying them for one final push to get out the vote, get people to caucus for him. This was about 4 hours before Iowans officially headed to caucus. I asked him, the first thing I asked him, because he hasn't gotten to come back to Vermont very much in the last year, probably as little as he's been in Vermont in any of the last 30 years. I said, what's your message to Vermonters? And he said, I want to thank them, because in many ways he credits Vermont as being the place where now nationally Iowa will get credit for this, being the place where his message really first took off, and in the sense that Vermont has made him one of the longest serving independents in the history of the United States legislature. And that is really where he's crafted his message over the last 30 years. Iowans love how genuine Bernie Sanders seemed. Vermonters know how genuine Bernie Sanders has been, because he's been saying the same thing over and over and over for years. Like him or not, he's been saying the same thing, and he really believes his message.
You were out there for about a week. What did you learn about Iowa?
You know, Iowa's just so unique. It's really interesting, because Iowa is not in any way representative of America. The people in Iowa are not a good representative sample of what America looks like. It's a state in the middle of the Midwest in which its industry is pretty limited. You don't have a wide swath of industries represented there. You have a high union turnout, relatively few African Americans, few Latinos, yet it is for 60 to 90 days for these candidates the most important thing in the world. And that's what makes Iowa unique, because it goes first. It's probably run its course of going first. There are certainly states that would be more representative of the U.S. to go first and start the political process. But Iowa has been so important ever since Jimmy Carter revived a campaign there, some 40 years ago now. And the most unique thing about Iowa is just that the intensity of your support really goes a long way there. Bernie Sanders has some intense, passionate followers, and I'm sure that played well there. Perhaps my favorite thing, when you get into a caucus room, you pick a candidate, you go into your different corners. Some candidates don't meet a viability threshold, which means they basically didn't get 15% support. Their candidates and their supporters, have to pick again. And so if you have persuasive people in the caucus room, it can really change a lot of minds. A lot of people told tales. Barack Obama's supporters were more persuasive than Hillary's in 2008. It made a big difference. I'm not sure how it broke last night, but having persuasive people in the caucus room is a big deal. It's not the secret vote like we're used to. It's not the go to the primary, cast your ballot, and walk out. It's a very public process and very interesting because it is so different from the system that the rest of the country uses.
And that's going to be the change that Bernie Sanders is going to have to make. Obviously, it's a ground game operation in Iowa with the caucus. Now it's a primary state, and that is, you don't go to somebody's living room. You go into a voting booth. How are they going to change tactics for New Hampshire, or have they said?
The good news is for New Hampshire that he has a built-in block of support there that's as large as he's going to find anywhere. Bill Clinton has been saying all week that New Hampshire votes for their neighbor every time, unless an incumbent president tells him to do something differently, which is usually what does happen. Now, and so Bernie Sanders has a built-in base of support there that should put him in position to likely win New Hampshire a week from now. The difference is going to be that it's not so much about getting people to the polls and making sure young people know how to even participate. You've really just got to make sure that you're able to get your people to the polls in the first place. Once they get there, that's easy. In Iowa, you got to teach them how to participate. Bernie Sanders wanted to turn out young voters. He did so well, 185,000 to turn out in Iowa yesterday. That's a very good number for the Sanders campaign. They increase turnout like that in every state. They are going to find some success in certain pockets of America, and I think that's going to be important for them moving forward in New Hampshire and as they go across the United States. But the biggest difference is their job really probably is not easy, but easier. Because once you get people to the polls, it's fairly self-explanatory from there.
Alex, we've lit up the lines here. I'm going to try to get to a couple phone calls before the top of the hour when you have to go. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Really exciting last night, actually. Bernie's not going to beat Hillary, I don't think. Hillary's going to beat Hillary. And I think Bernie has already alluded to it, that these emails, these classified emails that ended up on a server, which, from my hearing, you can't send a classified to an unsecured server, first of all. The State Department security is set up that he can't do it. And so they had to have been remarked on classified to even get to a server. But anyway, I think Bernie has alluded to that. This is a serious problem. I think it's going to get worse. And I think there's some sense in saying that Hillary is going to suffer. She's going to go down in flames, possibly, or even have to back out if she is even called by the FBI to be.
Let me go with that for a minute, Rob, because we're running out of time.
Okay.
Let me go with that for just a minute. Is Bernie going to bring up the emails, and is the Clinton camp, Alex, really worried about this email?
I think the Clinton camp is definitely very, very worried about it. How much Bernie Sanders brings it up, big debate, one-on-one, the first one in New Hampshire, coming up this week. How much he brings it up, I'm not sure. By the same token, though, Bernie Sanders has to worry that some voters think that his base of support is too narrow and that Clinton is actually the more practical choice if they're looking to make sure that progressive values can continue to get pushed in Washington. So they both have something that's pulling them back a little bit. How well they both handle that is going to go a long way in deciding.
Tom, I'm only going to get one more in. Let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, if you can do it in about 30 seconds, I would appreciate it.
Absolutely. Three quick comments. First of all, in 53 years on my planet, this is the most unique campaign season I've ever been aware of. Secondly, when it comes to money, do not discount the fact that Trump was supported and bailed out multiple times by banks. If not for being the first of the big, too big to fail, he would not be in this position. Also, Bernie Sanders is supported by MoveOn.org. MoveOn.org is supported by George Soros, who was worth over $20 billion. But more importantly, the last comment is this. This is a campaign season about one thing, and is that it's an establishment on both sides of the aisle versus unique and out-of-the-beltway type candidates, both Bernie Sanders and Ted Cruz, who don't follow establishment rules.
Hey, thank you, Paul, for your phone call. Alex, there's a lot going on, and I realize there's there's callers that we could probably keep going all day with. Just let me ask this. What is up for you today, and what is up for the campaigns today in New Hampshire?
I am headed back from Manchester right now. Adam Sullivan from our station will cover Sanders' rally in Manchester today. I have not looked at Secretary Clinton's schedule since I've been back. I know that she is coming to New Hampshire. She didn't get out of Iowa quite as quickly last night. And if you'll remember, the turnout was really high amidst some fears that a blizzard could really inhibit some people's ability to vote. It ended up holding off in most of Iowa. One last thing I'll leave you with. How close was Iowa? It was so close that in three precincts, Hillary Clinton won those precincts because of a coin flip. And so that is as close as it gets, and it's the closest vote in Iowa in the history of the Democratic caucus there.
Alex Apple, WCAX reporter. Thanks a lot, Alex. I really appreciate your time this morning. Get some
Anytime.
Sleep.
Anytime. Thanks, Mike.
And get some sleep. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. And if you want to listen to this show, you can go on WDEVradio.com and click on the Open Mic podcast. Listen to any show you want. Coming up, we'll talk with our friends at Talk Media News. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. As we wait for our friends, our colleagues from Talk Media News to call in, let me set up the second hour, because I think we're going to be talking, guess what, about Iowa when they call in. So let me set up the second hour. There's a very interesting story that is circulating through Vermont, and it's on the ongoing criminal investigation against Vermont environmentalist Annette Smith. And what's interesting to me is, who's behind these charges against Smith? No one is saying. What I plan to do is go through sort of chronologically some of the things that have been coming out on this story. We'll review what is going on, and I really want to get your take with your phone calls on what is happening. Because to me, this is kind of a bizarre story that involves industrial wind, the AG's office, developers, law firms, and politics. So I want to get your take, and I'll just jump into it right now and start reading. Last week, this all started when Vermont Digger did a story, and it was headlined, AG's office investigating complaints against Annette Smith, anti-wind advocate. And the story, and I won't read all of it, but I'll read the pertinent parts, because I think it's important that we go through chronologically what is going on here, and wanted to get your opinions. And if you want to call, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. First, the Digger story that came out last week, and I'm going, as I said, I'm going to jump through this story. I won't read the whole thing, but I'll read the pertinent parts of the story. It says the Attorney General's office is investigating whether Annette Smith, executive director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment has practiced law without a license, a charge with penalties left entirely to the court's discretion. Smith says that the complaints that prompted the AG's investigation are politically motivated. Attorneys who have argued against Smith's clients say she gives bad advice, unconstrained by the sanctions licensed attorneys would incur for similar behavior. Smith says the AG's investigation is very intimidating. This is, quote, "I don't know what to do. I think our work's being shut down," Smith said. "I believe this has the potential to shut down my organization of 16 years. It clearly falls under the definition of harassment." The story goes on and says, residents who lived near planned or existing renewable projects had claimed she's their only advocate. Smith says she represents people who too frequently have nowhere else to turn. Renewable energy developers hire talented attorneys against whom landowners near project sites have no other way of successfully representing themselves. Many of these cases involve people who can't afford a lawyer and who didn't want to become involved in the legal proceedings to protect their interests, she says, and that's Smith. Lawyers know it's impossible to fight renewable energy developers, Smith said, and won't take on affected landowners' cases anyway. Anyway, who does it? This is a quote. Anyway, who does this with a lawyer? With a lawyer has wasted tens of thousands of dollars, she said. The reason I'm doing this is so people have a voice without bankrupting themselves. The attorney general would not comment on the case. Jocelyn Wilsek is one of the attorneys, and in a previous public service board hearing, she told hearing officers that Smith had been in that instance practicing law without a license. Remember this name, because this name will pop up again in another story that we're talking about. Wilsek says that Smith gives legal advice to landowners and she drafts her filings to the Public Service Board, and I think it's a real disservice because she puts herself out there as having knowledge of a lawyer when she doesn't. Wilsek said she didn't file the complaint against Smith with the AG's office, but said she supports it and said that if asked and if her clients consented, she'd testify Smith had done what she's accused of. And then the story goes on with another lawyer. It says this is a person who Smith has advocated for, Annette Smith has advocated for. She says what she does is she provides citizens, normal, everyday citizens in the state of Vermont, with the possibility of having any chance at participating in the Public Service Board process, said Christine Lang. And another lawyer, Leslie Codwell, says that, and she represents wind developer David Blitterdorf, says Smith has led her clients to bad ends. Codwell participated in a case against Smith that complaints with the AG's office have highlighted as representative of Smith's alleged illegal behavior. And so this is sort of what kicked this story off last week, is that the AG's office is doing a criminal investigation against Annette Smith, Vermont environmentalist. Many of you know that she's been a thorn in the side of the powerful, and she now faces a criminal probe. If you wish to join this conversation, or you know anything of it, or you have an opinion dealing with this probe, we'll continue with some of the background material in just a moment. But you can always call us at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone lines and Brian Doobie. Brian Doobie, you're on Open Mic. Good morning, Brian.
Hey, Mike. How you doing?
Great, thank you.
Hey, Mike, I wanted to call and just maybe share my perspective on this story.
Sure.
So I live in Fairfield, and as a former lieutenant governor, obviously I know government, and I was approached by a number of neighbors that were literally threatened by a proposed project up here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important for your listeners for me to share what I learned. I approached a friend who's probably one of the most respected land use attorneys in our state, and I'm sure you know him. His name is John Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
He's a former representative from Montpelier. He's a Democrat. He's a great guy. And I approached him, and I said, John, could you help this group kind of navigate the Public Service Board process and advise this group on, you know, how we should respond, or if people want to channel their questions and energies in a productive way? And John's an attorney. He's in the business of, you know, hiring out his services. And John looked at me in the eye and he said, Brian, I wouldn't recommend you hire me. You're going to be wasting your money. This project is a done deal. All these projects are done deals. The Public Service Board is doing what the legislature has asked them to do, and they're approving these projects. And I wouldn't recommend you hire me. And that's why people are turning to Annette Smith, because they're without hope. I asked John Anderson if I could use, you know, that his statement, and he said, "Yeah, go ahead, use it. That's you know, I give you my permission to share my opinion about what's going on in our state." So people are really without hope. Communities really see a process that's all for the developers and doesn't really allow them. They can hire lawyers and they can hire experts, but the citizens really cannot participate directly, and that's why they're turning to Annette Smith.
And Brian, let me ask you this. I mean, this process seems to be very secretive. We don't know who's pressing the charges against Smith. Is that the normal process, or do you know?
It's certainly not the Vermont process. Can you imagine a world where secret allegations are made against, you know, citizens who are trying to engage in their government, and they don't even know who the charges are, you know, are leveled? It was reported in Vermont Watchdog that they made a connection to a large wind developer. But where does openness and transparency enter into this in a world of secret allegations of people, communities? This isn't just like NIMBY people. This is like the town of Swanton. This is the town of Grafton, the town of Irisburg. There's 94 towns that have signed on to what's called the Vermont, you know, Energy Rebellion. These aren't just individuals, Mike. These are towns that feel like they don't have the budget. They don't have the means, because it costs thousands and thousands of dollars to participate in the Public Service Board process. And that's why people are turning to, you know, someone like Annette Smith, who's got the expertise and got the experience. And I'm not, as I said, I'm not just talking about individuals. I'm talking about towns. Municipal governments feel like they don't have the budget to participate in this Public Service Board process.
Hey, Brian, thank you so much for your phone call. I appreciate it. We're talking, I want to sort of go on to the next phase, which was an Associated Press story that was written by David Graham. It was headlined, Annette Smith, Thorn in the Side of the Powerful, Faces Criminal Probe. And this story is interesting as well. It came out Sunday night. Remember, the Digger article was last week. This was Sunday night that this article came out, and it says Annette Smith has been fighting the power for more than 15 years, tenaciously opposing energy projects she believes harm the environment or the quality of life in Vermont. She is the target of a criminal investigation into whether her efforts constitute unlicensed legal work, but her allies say her only offense is too often annoying a green power industry that boasts deep pockets. And here's a quote from an attorney that wrote an op-ed, Deborah Bucknum. It says, even though she is even though this is a preposterous charge and will likely be thrown out, its purpose will be fulfilled to chill anyone's free speech rights who dare to question the powerful in Montpelier. Smith's efforts, the article goes on, to give towns and local groups greater say in large-scale renewable energy projects are meant to help those who cannot afford the high-priced lawyers that developers can, wrote Bucknam, who has represented critics of wind projects in the northeast, northeastern Vermont. Smith, 59, uses a small solar installation to power her home in Danby, where she milks a cow by hand and defies Vermont winters by growing citrus, limes, and grapefruit in a greenhouse. But she has been an outspoken critic of what she sees as the negative effects of large-scale wind and solar projects. Wildlife deaths and noise pollution from wind turbines, visual blight from sprawling solar arrays. She wouldn't comment on the specific allegations. Anything I say can be used against me, she said, but called the investigation a government-sponsored, what is called a SLAP. It's an acronym meaning a strategic lawsuit against public participation. The complaint filed with the state attorney general's office alleges Smith has improperly provided legal advice during public service board meetings. The complaint portrays Smith as usually working indirectly with those before the board, though it says on at least one occasion she attempted to directly participate because she wanted to streamline the process. The complaint letter was partially redacted, and the AG's office would not say who had sent it, but other documents and a footnote in the letter point to a law firm representing David Blitters. Dorf, a major solar and wind developer. Blitterdorf did not return calls seeking comment. The lawyer representing him said in an email he could not comment. So that was the AP story that came out Sunday night. There are two more stories that I think are important in trying to figure this whole thing out, but I do want to go to the phone lines. And if you want to join this conversation, and it gets bizarre and bizarre as we go on, if you wish to join this conversation, would welcome your phone calls at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Dick in St. Albans. Dick, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Brian Doobie was for windmills when they were in my front yard in Searsburg, Vermont. Now he's against windmills that are going to be in his backyard in Fairfield.
So you think it's a NIMBY thing?
Well, no. I think it's a fraud to begin with. This whole alternate energy thing is nothing but insider dealings, tax breaks, carbon credits being sold. And it's a massive scam. And the issue is that the scam that's being projected here out of getting you out of fossil fuels and all this other crap. You know, you got a cartel of criminals running this state, and you can find most of them in your lawyer's office. You know, we got to get all the lawyers out of the state legislature for one thing, because these guys down there are really setting agendas to make work for themselves, and it's really time to clean house. It's clean house. About 20 of those senators need to go, and I'd say about 50 to 75 of those House members need to go. Enough is enough.
Thanks, Dick. I really appreciate your phone call. One of the things that I want to get through these next couple of articles just to give you some context of what's going on. VermontWatchdog.org yesterday published a story, said law firm for green energy CEO investigated anti-big renewables activists, and it says, according to documents posted on the blog for Vermonters for Clean Energy, Burlington-based law firm Denise Kapp and McAndrew has been gathering files on Annette Smith, the group's director. And one of the things it goes through, this article goes through various various sort of things that the law firm has done. On October 28th, the law firm, which represents All Earth Renewable CEO David Blittersdorf, sent public records requests to the town of Morgan and Irisburg to inquire about services Smith provided to the local renewable energy projects. And one of the things that they asked for is information that Smith received attorney compensation during that time. Again, neither Blittersdorf nor the attorney would speak to Associated Press or Watchdog.org. And one of the things that this article points out, that the recent file gathering on Smith is certain to raise eyebrows of those who feel Vermont's energy profile is rife with conflicts of interest, something that that Dick had just mentioned. One of the attorneys of the law firm that we mentioned, House Speaker Shap Smith, appoints the powerful chairman of the House Committee on Natural Resources. That committee, led by Chair State Representative Tony Klein of East Montpelier, helped pass Vermont's new Renewable Portfolio Act 46. I'm just trying to see, you know, again, there's people coming out and supporting Annette Smith. If you went back to the Vermont Digger article, there were 150 comments on that article. There are 18 on this. This morning, one of the things that came out of the Rutland Herald was GMP activist did not cross the line. And you're wondering how GMP got involved in this. Well, the attorney, the Montpelier attorney representing GMP, which was Jocelyn Wilshek, which I had mentioned earlier, which was mentioning that she would testify against Smith, was representing GMP during one of those proceedings where allegedly Annette Smith had provided legal services. But GMP is sort of distancing themselves from Jocelyn Wilshek, the Montpelier attorney. And GMP has said, Green Mountain Power believes strongly that decisions are made best when all voices are heard. This is a statement from GMP. That is why we are so committed to working closely with local communities, stakeholders, and partners when energy projects are being considered, said Kristen Carlson, communications chief executive for GMP. As I'm sure you know, we have ardently disagreed with some of Annette Smith's positions, but we have never witnessed her crossing any line beyond what active citizens do. We appreciate the passion she brings to the public debate, and we believe her perspective is an important one. So a lot of things happening here, and I'm asking, you know, we don't know who is filing the charges against Smith. The AG hasn't released the names of those people who have filed those complaints against Smith. We don't know a lot about why they're filing this, although they do refer to specific cases. But I'm interested in your thoughts. What the heck do you think is going on here? This is such a bizarre story that involves everyone. I mean, it involves politics, it involves industrial wind, it involves the AG's office, developers, law firms, politicians. Be very interested in your take. We got full phone lines. Let's go to Bill in Barrie. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I think it's, first of all, I praise Annette Smith for what she's doing. She's standing alone against a giant, let's say. But I do have a thought. It hasn't been mentioned. I thought it would be. Annette Smith is not a professional lawyer. I've always heard we have a First Amendment to give us the right to speak and to give people advice. But does she receive any money for what she's doing? Or does she collect it from donations and then gives her advice to these people free? I think this if she doesn't get anything from the people she's helping, or expect anything from the people she's helping, I don't see how she can be considered a professional lawyer.
Hey, Bill, thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Whit in South Carolina. Whit, you're on open mic. Good morning, Whit.
I'm going to tell you, from the outside, Vermont, the top story for me as a cat person is whether or not Boots the Cat has returned home yet.
You're talking about a CAX story up in the Northeast Kingdom where Boots was taken from a house.
That's right.
Is that what you're talking about?
That's a cat that's been kidnapped, and my heartstrings are pounding. I just need to know what's going to happen to that little kitty.
Let's go back to the subject at hand, Annette Smith.
What I wanted to say was last night I was very heartened by what I saw on TV by Bernie's tying the billery. And let me say this. You had a guest on earlier that I didn't completely hear, but he was saying black establishment and politics in North South Carolina are not with Bernie Sanders. Well, I don't know that I can speak with authority on this, but I sent you a news story recently last week where a lot of the black folks down here have turned from the billery and they're now supporting Sanders. And this one gentleman, who seems to have some influence, of course he's just one gentleman, is saying that Sanders has a bold platform and Hillary is old-time politics. Now what they're trying to do is sell a billery down here because she's got network. She's into Jesse Jackson. She's this, she's that. But look, she doesn't really engage passion the way Bernie Sanders does. And even if Bernie can't do anything in 4 years, you know what? He's going to stand up for especially retired folks. Hillary will do nothing for Social Security. She couldn't care any less about people that are on Social Security. She has a $50 million bankroll. But read that story, and you're going to find out that maybe Bernie does have a chance down here in South Carolina. You never know.
I will, Whit. Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to West Brookfield. You're on open mic. Good morning.
Yes, good morning, Mike. I'm calling regarding the renewable energy.
Sure.
And I sit in the camp where I'm pro renewable energy, but I am absolutely anti industrial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think just my perception and take on what's going on is it's a power grab because we're sitting in a place where homeowners can now finance out their own power source at a comparable rate to what power companies offer you to sell you power at. And that sets up a situation where potentially homeowners and private property could have all the energy source they could ever want. And it would make a public service board and an entire level of bureaucracy and an entire industry of providing energy irrelevant.
And you think they're afraid of that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Because the faster they can start saying, well, we'll provide you the renewable energy, the better off they are. And the more those are held up, the more private installations can go in. And then they're required to buy back the energy.
Mm-hmm.
In net metering agreements.
Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Bruce in Essex. Bruce, you're on open mic.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
Great, thank you.
I don't want to talk directly about Annette Smith or renewable energy per se, because I do think there's a larger issue here, and that's fear.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a judge on the United States Court of Circuit Appeals for the Southern District of California named Alex Kaczynski. And I heard him make a speech several years ago, maybe in the early 90s. He had just come back from Romania, where he was born, and he was speaking to a conservative group, and he said, there's more free speech in Romania now that they've deposed the dictator. People are talking about ideas. They're talking about the future. They're not longer afraid. But I come back now to the United States, and I believe even though we have free speech guaranteed by our Constitution, people are afraid. They're afraid to speak their mind. They're afraid of what their neighbor will think or their boss, you know, colleague at work. He said, "People," and this is what I believe this is about. I've been threatened by an attorney, and some of my neighbors have over a dispute over a land issue, and we got threatened with criminal action and things like this. It's an attempt to make people frightened, and the signal is being sent, you know, we can do this to Annette Smith, who's a very skillful person, you know, just be quiet yourself. And I think that goes against the grain of what we're doing. If the Attorney General wants to pursue this, that's up to him, and I'm not criticizing they're entertaining a complaint, but it's that larger issue, and I think we have to be aware of it. And I think the benefit, and I feel very bad for Annette Smith, I don't think it's an easy position to be in, but the benefit of this is to make us aware of the fact that people do have to be able to speak truth to power, and those of us who are little guys have to join together and do it, because otherwise they're just going to try to silence our voice.
Great observation, Bruce. Thank you for your phone call. I'm going to just switch gears for a little bit, and then I'm going to come back to your phone calls. So keep those phone calls coming on this subject. Welcome back to Open Mic. This is Mike Smith. In this hour, we're talking about a very interesting story that's been dominating the news on the front page of the Rutland Herald, in an AP story yesterday, on the front page of the Rutland Herald both days today. It's about an interesting story of an ongoing criminal investigation against Vermont environmentalist Annette Smith, who's and the question that many people are asking is, who's behind these charges against Smith? Because it has not been disclosed by the Attorney General's office who is behind it. No one is saying who's behind it. What I've been doing the last 20 or 30 minutes is reviewing what is going on. And there's been a lot going on in the last few days. Started out with a Vermont Digger article, went to an AP story over the weekend that came out on Sunday night, went to a VermontWatchdog.org story that ran yesterday, and then this morning on the front page of the Rutland Herald, another story dealing with this. And what I want to do is review what's going on with you and get your opinion, because this is a bizarre story that involves a number of people, including people that are in Industrial Wind, the AG's office, developers, law firms, environmentalists, politicians, and politics. So we'd welcome your calls if you wish to call us at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Fairfield and a caller from Fairfield. Good morning. You're on Open Mic.
Hello.
Hello.
So I'm calling because it seems, you know, first of all, I want to say Vermont's really lucky to have somebody like Annette Smith who's willing to speak out against injustices. And I'm calling because I think the watchdog story really does tie in David Blittersdorf to this particular issue, the wind developer. And it also ties in Shapp Smith's law firm. Now, I'm sure with more investigative reporters looking into it, that connection will become even more solid. And I look forward to that, actually, because corruption in Vermont is something that I think most Vermonters would feel extremely sad about, knowing that this kind of money is going on behind the scenes to influence how things are done here in Vermont. That's not the Vermont way.
Well,
and the federal subsidies that go into these particular projects, you know, the millions and the billions of dollars, would support small-scale renewables for homes, for homeowners in Vermont and for small businesses in Vermont, in ways that, you know, the average Vermonter could never even begin to see, because it just goes into the big developers' pockets, and in this case, politicians' pockets as well. And I think if you follow the money, you'll begin to see that thread connect even further.
Thank you for your phone call. Let's go to Andy in Middlesex. Andy, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, and thank you very much for taking my call. I have just a couple of short comments, one relating to Annette Smith, et cetera, and the other somewhat related, actually, to Bernie and his recent vote. First of all, I used to be with Annette Smith in her campaign against wind, industrial wind, because I was a supporter of Vermont Yankee nuclear power or some sort of nuclear power plant. And it seems funny to me now, where were all these people who object to renewable energy when Vermont Yankee was the issue? You know, we could have avoided all this had people realized that Vermont Yankee was a safe, localized source of power, much more reliable, cheaper, et cetera, than all of the wind, all of the solar that's going to have to cover Vermont to replace it. So where were all these people when Vermont Yankee was the issue? Second, Annette Smith is an honorable person. She believes passionately in saving our mountaintops. But I think the issue now is the world needs power. We need power. And if people won't go for nuclear power, then I'm afraid they're going to have to live with industrial wind on our mountaintops and solar panels in our valleys. I mean, an advanced country such as ours cannot keep its competitive edge without lots and lots of electricity. Also, I think the comments about Shap Smith being corruptible are libelous. I happen to know Shap, and he is a very upright, upstanding man who would never, ever be corrupt. I think people who know him realize that about Shap. If anything, he's the most decent, uncorruptible politician in the state of Vermont. Now, on Bernie, these ruinous lawsuits attempting to stop Annette Smith remind me of Bernie's recent vote to support the repeal of the Lawful Commerce, Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, which actually protects gun manufacturers against frivolous but financially ruinous lawsuits directed against the small traditional industry that manufactures products that are legal, that are safe if properly used, lawsuits that blame the manufacturer for the work of criminals who misuse their product. Now, Bernie was first elected to Congress and got his national career started because gun owners of Vermont withheld their support from Republican Congressman Peter Smith, who had voted in favor of the so-called assault weapons ban. And they were so angry at Smith that they essentially elected Bernie to Congress, and where he was able to make a national name for himself. So the idea of suing somebody to accomplish your ends is related to what they're trying to do to Annette Smith, who is an honorable person, although I now disagree with her due to the fact that we no longer have Vermont Yankee.
Thanks for your phone call, Andy. And what we're talking about, of course, is this sort of bizarre story that involves industrial wind, the AG's office, developers, law firms, and politics and political figures. And it started last week with the Vermont Digger article. It went over the weekend with an AP story. The AP story's headlines was Annette Smith, thorn in the side of the powerful, and she faces criminal probe. And just to set this back up for our listeners that may have just joined us, and if you have just joined us and you have an opinion on this, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255 to set this back up. Annette Smith has been, this is an AP story that I'm reading from right now, and I'll read from that, a watchdog.org story, and then a story in the Rutland Herald this morning. And I'm only going to take snippets out of these and try to give you the full flavor of what this is about. Annette Smith has been fighting the power for more than 15 years, tenaciously opposing energy projects she believes harm the environment or the quality of life in Vermont. Now she is the target of a criminal investigation into whether her efforts constitute unlicensed legal work. But her allies say her only offense is too often annoying a green power industry that boasts deep pockets. And an attorney that wrote an op-ed, Deborah Buckingham, said this. She said, even though this is a preposterous charge and will likely be thrown out, its purpose will be fulfilled to chill anyone's free speech who dares to question the powerful in Montpelier. And that is something that even Annette Smith said, although she won't comment on the specifics of the allegations. She said, because she said anything I say can be used against me, but she called the investigation a government-sponsored, what is called a slap suit, which is an acronym meaning strategic lawsuit against public participation. And the story goes on to talk about how this is happening. The AG is doing an investigation based on a complaint where they will not say who filed the complaint against her. And the Vermont Watchdog in a story yesterday talked about the fact that files were gathered on Smith that are probably going to raise some eyebrows, who feel that Vermont's energy profile is rife with conflicts of interest, including, it goes on here, that the Speaker of the House, Shap Smith's law firm, was involved in collecting some of the information that was gathered to present a case rather against Smith. It says on October 28th, the law firm, which represents all recyclable CEO David Blittersdorf, sent public records requests to the towns of Morgan and Irisburg to inquire about services Smith provided the local renewable project. So there's a lot going on here. We're just trying to sort it out, get your opinion about various things. Give us a call if you have an opinion, if you've followed this story, if you know Annette Smith, if you know something about this story. It is a bizarre story that gets more bizarre each day. So give us a call at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Annette Smith faces criminal probe. Do you think that's warranted or not? We have a call from Barnett. You're on open mic.
Good morning. Ted Ferris in Barnett calling. You do a great job taking over for Mark Johnson. I appreciate it greatly. Regarding Annette Smith and renewable energy, I don't have a dog in the fight. I was a selectman in town for 12 years, town health officer for 15 or so. If I was cited into court every time I gave legal advice or an opinion on an issue, the courts would be swamped, and I'm sure all selectmen and health officers fall into the same category.
So you think that this suit is, I'm trying to get to what you're thinking is on this suit or on this probe, actually, Ted?
Absolutely ridiculous. If she hasn't filed papers, a motion, or something in court for the people she deals with and hasn't taken financial compensation, boy, this is a joke.
Hey, thank you very much, Ted, for your call. Let's go to Elton in Wilka. Elton, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to also point out that there's another strange case connected with wind power, and it was on the Lowell Range, and the six people that were arrested there for trespassing on, I think it was a 26-acre piece of land that was supposedly owned by the Nelsons, the farmers that owned a large farm at the base of the mountain and going up the side of the mountain. But a corner of that property was being used to get these big windmill pieces and access to the ridge. Six people were arrested for trespassing. They were convicted, and the case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was found that they were guilty, even though the issue of who owned the land had not yet been settled. And one justice wrote a dissent on that issue, saying that, let me read it here. He noted that the property ownership needed to be established before trespassing charges could hold, and they were not. And these people still have these charges on their background from that. So we need to worry about our court system as well in connection with these strange happenings.
Thank you for the phone call, Elton. We'll continue our conversation about Annette Smith. No one knows, or no one's saying at least, who's been behind filing charges against her in terms of practicing law without a license. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. This is Mike Smith. We've had a robust discussion this morning about Annette Smith, executive director of the Vermonters for a Clean Environment, and the fact that somebody has filed a complaint against her saying she stepped over the line and practiced law without a law license. And what the complaint is being investigated, and it's a criminal complaint by the Attorney General's office. And several, as I mentioned before, several attorneys, Jocelyn Wilczek, who's an energy attorney, and also there's another attorney, Leslie Cadwell, who's another energy attorney, say that she has stepped over the line, although they are not the ones, they claim, who have filed the complaint. Ironically, today, in the front page of the Rutland Herald, Green Mountain Power released a statement that said it believes strongly that decisions are best made when all voices are heard. That is why we are so committed to working closely with local communities, stakeholders, and partners when energy projects are being considered, said Kristen Carlson, chief communication executive for GMP. As I'm sure you know, we ardently disagree with some of Annette Smith's positions, but we have never witnessed her crossing any line beyond what active citizens would do. We appreciate the passion she brings to the public debate, and we believe her perspective is an important one. If you've got any opinion, now's the time to call. We'll try to get your phone calls in. 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. It's going to be like 30-second phone calls if you do try to get in. But this is an interesting story to me, because what's very interesting is that it's an ongoing criminal investigation against someone who believes strongly about against industrial wind and what it's doing to the mountaintops, and yet charges have been filed against her. No one is saying who filed the charges. It seems a little preposterous that a person wouldn't know who would file the charges. And it combines a bunch of things in this whole story that makes it interesting I think, for many Vermonters. It combines the growth of industrial wind, the AG's office, and why they're investigating and what they're doing in their investigation. It involves developers, wind developers, and law firms who represent those developers, and activists. And if you go and look at some of the comments on Vermont Digger, 151 comments there. Other comments are enormous, mostly in support of Annette Smith. And today, I think you got a sort of a glimpse that there is much support for Annette Smith. I want to thank our guests today. We'll move on and we'll close out this show. But I want to thank our guests today, which were Eric Davis, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Middlebury College, Steve Terry, who is a political analyst for WCAX, longtime political observer, and Alex Apple, who had not a lot of sleep flying back from Iowa last night on the Bernie Sanders plane. He's a WCAX reporter and has been doing a fantastic job in reporting out in Iowa, and will continue to be reporting about the presidential primary race. Tomorrow in Open Mic, Bruce Lisman will be in studio and we'll talk about his bid for governor. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow.